The U.S. Supreme Court ruled yesterday that some for-profit corporations, like Hobby Lobby, have religious rights and cannot be forced to cover certain contraceptives for their employees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, July 1st. We will talk with our guest expert about the implications of this decision, as well as a separate ruling from the Supreme Court yesterday that limits the reach of public labor unions. We'll talk about that public employee union case a little bit later in the hour. But right now we want to know if you think the Supreme Court got it right or wrong when it comes to corporations being able to deny contraception coverage. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, and he's an affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what exactly the U.S. Supreme Court said when it comes to Hobby Lobby and the other companies who objected to covering contraceptives for their employees?
Well, it's a little hard to break down because there's a lot of disagreement even among the justices as to exactly what the implications of the rule are. But Justice Alito, writing for a 5-4 majority, ruled that closely held corporations, which means corporations in which more than half the stock is owned by five or fewer investors, may not be compelled to participate in funding insurance for contraception, if the holders of that majority share of the stock have religious objections to those forms of contraception. So it's sort of got multiple pieces. First, it singles out a class of corporations, closely held corporations, and said these entities have the right to assert religious objections on behalf of their shareholders. Then it applied a federal law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and said that where a federal law infringes on religious objections, it has to pass the very strict test to avoid making allowances for making exceptions for people who have religious objections, and that in this case, the Affordable Care Act fails.
All right. So, so this is not just Hobby Lobby. This could affect many other companies?
This is, in fact, 90% of all corporations in the United States, employing 52% of all American workers.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. Now, it is exceedingly unlikely that all or most or even, you know, half of those corporations will come up with religious objections. But they could, and it would save them money to do so. So there's suddenly an incentive for closely held corporations to discover religious objections of which they might have been previously unaware. There are a couple of other pieces about this case that need to be focused on. One of the big disagreements is between Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito. Justice Ginsburg insists that this is a holding, in her words, of startling breadth. And the reason she says that is, if this company can get an exemption from having to pay for insurance for these particular four forms of contraception, why can't some other company similarly claim they should be exempted from laws about discrimination or laws about paying for insurance for other medical procedures like blood transfusions or vaccinations, right? So Ginsburg argues that the logic of this case opens a door to sweeping claims of exemption from otherwise applicable laws by corporations on the basis of this claim that they have religious beliefs. Alito, writing for the majority, insists this isn't true. He says this only applies to contraception. The problem is he has absolutely no explanation for why that should be the case.
Yeah, so what are the four forms of contraception that can be denied now?
Well, this gets to be yet another debate. Yeah. So these are four forms of contraception that work according to medical authorities by preventing eggs from becoming fertilized. The claim that Hobby Lobby raises, and some right-wing groups and some representatives of the Catholic Church have raised, some, not all, is that in fact, in some cases, these forms of contraception can result in a fertilized egg being prevented from implanting.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the Catholic Church comes in. In the Catholic Church's view, if an egg is fertilized, then life has begun, and any action that would prevent that a fertilized egg from continuing its progress of growth is the equivalent of an abortion.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
I may add one note, there's actually a group called the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. And the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs insists that the Catholic Church's theory is simply false, that there is, in their words, no direct evidence in the literature to say that these forms of contraception are, in fact, abortifacient agents. So we have yet another level of strangeness, which is not only do corporations have the right to assert religious objections, they apparently have the right to determine for themselves the scientific basis on which these religious objections will apply.
Yeah, because I have been reading that Hobby Lobby already provides, or without objection, provides contraception coverage, like for the plain old birth control pill.
That's right.
And now what they don't like, they don't want the morning after pill or other things like that being covered.
That's correct. But by the logic of the opinion, and I have to say, I think Ginsburg has this absolutely right. I can't see any way out of this. By the logic of the opinion, Hobby Lobby or a different company could say, we have religious objections to contraception, we won't cover any of it. In fact, by the logic of the opinion, I have to say it again, it's very difficult to see how you can limit this principle to even the case of contraception as opposed to other medical procedures, or for that matter, to other federal laws.
And then critics, too, of this ruling are saying, well, Christians will be screaming if other companies that apply here that are maybe owned by different religions start to denying coverage for things in their religion that they don't like.
Well, one would assume so. So, again, you know, there's no reason, no obvious reason, and none that is identified by Justice Alito, why if a Jehovah's Witness is the majority shareholder in a closely held corporation, that corporation can't opt out of providing coverage for blood transfusions.
Yeah. Well, so I guess those are some of the practical applications or implications of this. What are some of the political implications of this ruling?
Right. So there's the law and the politics, and they're both really interesting. The politics is a little hard to predict. In one sense, obviously, this is a victory for conservatives and the religious right and opponents of Obamacare. Mm-hmm. After all, a piece of the Obamacare requirements has been limited in its application. There are two things about that, though, that really jump out. One is, if you're a Republican candidate running in the next cycle, it's not necessarily the case that you want to be publicly defending the outcome in Hobby Lobby. It depends on your district, of course, but it is plausible that this will become something that Democrats will use to attack Republicans, that Republicans would rather not talk about. The other thing is that, interestingly, the outcome in this case demonstrates, not for the first time, how much easier it is to simply publicly fund health insurance rather than try and arrange to have health insurance paid for by private employers. All of these complications arise because we insist on using private agents, employers, to provide a public good, in this case, Obamacare, right? So there's a law that says we want, as a public matter, to ensure that everyone has health insurance. That's a law passed by Congress. It's a public good. But then we say we're going to use private employers to deliver it and private insurance companies to deliver the payment for, right? The payment for this good. And that's where all of these complications arise, because various private parties are able to assert various claims that, well, they shouldn't be required to participate in this process. And this court is very eager to accommodate those claims. So the irony of this is that it actually ends up looking like a pretty strong argument in favor of having at least a partial single-payer option. And Alito says that explicitly in his opinion. He says one reason we can't justify forcing employers to pay for this coverage is because if the government really believes it's necessary, they can provide it themselves.
We are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday when the High Court sided with Hobby Lobby and some other companies. The ruling was that some for-profit corporations have religious rights and cannot be forced to cover certain contraceptives for their employees if they have religious objections to those contraceptives. So what do you make of this decision? We are talking about the legal and the political implications. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Howard Schwaber, a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, about the U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday regarding Hobby Lobby and contraception. And we welcome your questions and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our first caller is Joe in Madison. Hello, Joe.
Good morning, Joy. My question to Mr. Schwaber is, how does a organization deciding to opt out of providing contraception differ from an organization exerting its religious will upon its employees? If I start a company, I can't force my employees to be the same religion as me. But if I start a company and deny my employees access to contraception, isn't that kind of the same thing? And what's the legal difference there? And what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Let me give you Justice Alito's answer to that question, first of all, and then I'll comment on his answer. So Justice Alito would respond, no, there's no similar parallel. And the reason is, it's not that Hobby Lobby is preventing these employees from getting insurance coverage for this kind of contraception, let alone preventing them from using this kind of contraception. They just don't want to be forced to pay for it. So these employees are perfectly free to purchase that contraception on their own. They're perfectly free to purchase insurance for that contraception on their own. And for that matter, the government is perfectly free to fund that insurance. They just can't require the employer to be the one to pay for that cost. The problem, as you point out, I think, is that this really opens the door to employers at least making it much more difficult to obtain any kind of coverage or any kind of protection to which the employer has religious objections. So it's not quite the case of an employer imposing their religion on employees, but it's certainly the case that an employer is given the power to give, let's say, preferential treatment to activities that their religion approves of and make it more difficult for employees to follow other activities. And that should be a cause for concern, I think.
Thanks very much, Joe, for the call. Joe was also saying to my producer that the Supreme Court just got this wrong. Corporations are not people. This decision further, I don't know, advances that philosophy that corporations are people?
Well, that's right. And in fact, not only are corporations persons, but corporations as persons have been gaining rights with great frequency over the last couple of years at the hands of this particular Supreme Court. And there is something incoherent about that. So historically, in, for example, First Amendment jurisprudence, I think it's important to recognize this case was decided under a federal statute, not the First Amendment, although there are very close parallels. But historically, under First Amendment jurisprudence, we've only granted freedom of association rights to what are called expressive associations. That is, it's not any group of people gathering for any purpose that has First Amendment rights. It's only when people form an association for the purpose of expressing a view, including a religious view, that we treat that association as having rights of its own. That's historically been the case, going back all the way 50 years. This idea that business corporations, which are not formed for expressive purposes, have these same kind of First Amendment rights is brand new and doesn't really hold up very well to analytical scrutiny. So in his opinion, again, Alito says, well, corporations are formed for purposes that go beyond just profit. They can pursue any lawful undertaking, and with the consent of their shareholders, they can choose to pursue moral goods. And that's all true in one sense. The two things about that are jarringly inconsistent with any other analysis is, first, that's not what the corporation was formed for in the first place, and secondly, the idea of consent to the shareholders ignores the fact that these are decisions made on the basis of voting shares, not individuals. That is, whoever owns 51% of the shares gets to make the decision, not 51% of the members of the association. So this isn't an organization that aggregates the views of some kind of members and expresses those views to the public. This is an organization that aggregates money and then uses that money as a platform for the views of whoever is the majority shareholder, which was exactly the strangeness of Citizens United that talked about corporations having speech rights. So I think it's a very good question, and I think that the argument that this court is pursuing, that corporations are persons with specifically First Amendment rights of personhood, is frankly incoherent.
Daniel in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing, Joy?
Good. What do you think?
Well, the first thing is that I can't believe that people are attacking Hobby Lobby, considering that in this era of post-Affordable Health Care Act, so many companies that pay just above minimum wage are either paying the penalties for their employees so they don't have to provide any health care coverage, or are slashing their hours so that they don't, you know, they're all part-time or less, so they don't have to provide them with coverage. And I think that, you know, that Hobby Lobby is trying to take care of their employees. And also, to the last comment, corporations post Hoover era were all determined to be American entities, American corporations, whether it be one person or five people or 10 people or whatever, to protect them from the federal government forcing them to do things or investigating them without warrants. And it's another level of protection we have from overreaching government. And I just think that if you went and talked to the guys making $8 an hour at Hobby Lobby and gals, they'd probably be pretty pleased that they have health insurance as opposed to the folks at McDonald's and Burger King who, you know, who are out protesting.
All right. Thank you very much, Daniel. So Hobby Lobby should get credit for at least providing employees
sure.
with insurance.
Sure. Daniel makes two points, and they're both valid. One is that Hobby Lobby is not the worst actor out there, and that's quite right. But, of course, I think the important thing to realize is that a case like this one is not just about Hobby Lobby. You know, a case comes to the Supreme Court with particular parties, but the rule that's established in the case will apply broadly and across the board. And the concern here is that this rule applied broadly and across the board could have sweeping consequences. For example, one of the things that Justice Alito focused on was he said, look, this ruling does not mean that other corporations are exempt from laws preventing discrimination based on race. And he was very careful to say based on race, which leaves a glaring open question. What about companies that claim a religious basis for discriminating based on sexuality?
Mm-hmm.
And Alito had nothing to say about that. The Department of Health and Human Services argued that thousands of companies could raise these same kind of objections to other kinds of federal laws having to do with things like insurance, to which Alito's sole response was, well, it hasn't been proved that that will happen. So in other words, if this were just a lawsuit involving Hobby Lobby, it would be much less a matter of concern. Because the ruling in a case like this one applies very broadly, and because the author of the majority opinion had nothing to say about why that, you know, why those sweeping consequences should not be a matter of concern, this case becomes deeply worrying. As for the point about corporations, Daniel's right, of course, that protections, legal protections of corporate privacy and corporate records and so on have been instituted to prevent overreaching federal authorities carrying out criminal investigations. And that's perfectly fine. That does not necessarily translate, at least without some further analysis, into arguing that corporations should have all the rights afforded to human citizens under the Constitution. It's that move to giving free speech rights and freedom of religion rights to entities that are, after all, legal fictions in the first place that seems very strange. Don't forget, corporations exist only because legislation exists saying that they do. A state could abolish corporations altogether. It would be nuts, but legally they could do it. It's very hard to conceive of a category of citizen who only exists because the government says that it does.
Thanks for the call, Daniel. Cindy in Burlington is with us. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning, Joy.
Good morning.
I had a whole different question about vasectomies and stuff like that, but my change it to, I've been listening to Professor and all these legal issues and everything, and there's all these questions, and open-ended questions. It's like, how long will it be before someone actually goes and tries to reverse this, because there's so much openness to it, and no, and these questions that he's not answering. You know, how long will it be before this is reversed or challenged?
Sure. Well, I'm not trying to avoid answering any of these questions.
Oh, I think she meant Justice Scalia, I think.
Alito. Okay. What makes this case so striking and what makes a radical case like this so striking is that it does open so many questions. And what makes the court's opinion so disappointing is that there's so little effort to even pretend to try to answer them. I would expect that next term we will start seeing cases filtering up through the federal courts trying to either challenge or take advantage of this ruling. So, I mean, I can pretty well guarantee that there will be cases of corporations claiming religious exemptions from other aspects of the Affordable Care Act and from other federal laws, and that these will be heard in the federal courts. And over a period of a couple of years, these will filter up. And so I would think that within 3 or 4 years, the Supreme Court will be back trying to clarify the limits of this holding that they've issued.
Yeah. Well, we have just a minute before a news break. She was going to say that she was upset that Hobby Lobby would cover Viagra and vasectomies, but not birth control. But, I mean, I guess if an employer in this category says, I religiously object to vasectomies, they could deny coverage for that under this ruling?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, let's be clear, and Daniel made a good point here, as you did, Joy, Hobby Lobby is not saying we won't cover any forms of contraception, we won't cover anything having to do with reproduction. They have objections to a particular set of procedures, the morning after pill and so on, that they or their owners believe have the effect of creating what the Catholic Church considers the equivalent to an abortion.
Yeah.
That's a medically questionable judgment in the first place, but that is the basis for their claim. And Hobby Lobby is making a limited claim.
We will. We need to hold it there because we have news coming up next, and then we'll continue talking about these Supreme Court cases. We are talking about the legal and political implications of a major Supreme Court ruling handed down yesterday. Actually, two Supreme Court rulings. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Tuesday, July 1st. We are talking about the decision involving Hobby Lobby. And we promised that we would also touch on this case involving public employee unions and union dues. And we will welcome your questions and reactions about both cases and related issues at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison and an affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School. Our lines are full, Professor Schwaber, with people who have questions or reactions regarding this Hobby Lobby case. But we also wanted to ask you about this separate ruling handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday, which you can explain it probably better,
sure.
But it says mandatory public union dues violate some members' First Amendment rights. It's a case involving Illinois home health care workers who didn't belong to their public union, but they benefited from union negotiations. What happened there?
Right. Well, that's not exactly right.
Okay.
The case is called Harris versus Quinn, and there is an old precedent that says public employees can be forced to contribute to unions that engage in collective bargaining on their behalf. So there's a basic principle that public employee unions can operate in the same way that unions operate in the private sector. This case did not involve public employees, or at least according to the court. Again, Alito wrote this opinion as well. Instead, Alito drew a distinction between public employees and what he calls partial public employees, a new category. A partial public employee in this case is a home health care worker who's paid partly out of Medicaid, and so public funds, and partly on a sliding scale by the people receiving the care.
Oh.
And because these workers receive compensation partly from the state and partly privately, Alito said, they're not really public employees. And so this very special category of partial public employee cannot be compelled to contribute dues. It's also the case that the union that's involved here, the SEIU,
the Service Workers Union, it stands for Service Employees International Union, doesn't actually engage in collective bargaining with the state because the rates that are paid are set by the state government. But they do negotiate. They do discuss with the state. And in fact, over a period of several years, they've succeeded in getting the benefits and salary received by these home health care workers in Illinois significantly improved. So in 2003, these were people making $7 an hour. In 2014, they're making $13 an hour, and they have some state-financed health insurance and other benefits. We're talking about some of the lowest-paid workers in America, and we're also talking about a category of employee that's one of the big growth sectors. The growth in low-wage health care work is one of the largest areas of employment growth in the United States. And so this is a ruling that could cover a very large number of people, and it will mean that because individual employees can opt out of paying their dues, which everyone has an incentive to do, obviously, the unions that are involved will be much less able to negotiate effectively with the state employers. Ironically, this is yet another case where the problem arises because of the desire to deliver a public good partly through private actors. If the state simply paid the salaries of these workers outright, then they'd be public employees and this rule wouldn't apply.
So the National Journal called this a devastating blow to public sector unions.
No, that's not right.
Yeah.
Because Alito was very careful. Now, it's an ominous sign for public sector unions. The rumor is that Alito was trying to get 5 votes to make this rule apply to public sector unions in general. And certainly nothing in his opinion is likely to prevent further challenges trying to push the rule to apply to public unions in general. And in fact, there are already a couple of cases in federal court, you know, sort of percolating their way through the system that are going to raise those challenges. So we're pretty sure that Justice Alito would like to extend this rule to end mandatory dues by all public sector unions. But for the moment, at least, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Governor Walker reacted to this ruling by saying the Supreme Court ruling today reinforces the Act 10 reforms eliminating the requirement for public employees to pay union dues, and goes on to say that, you know, in essence, that it's sort of a vindication of Act 10. Would you agree?
No. And again, because the ruling didn't go there. So to put this in context, we have to go back to a case from the late 70s called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. That was a case where teachers, I mean, this is directly applicable to Act 10, teachers challenged mandatory dues to their teachers' union. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it's perfectly okay to require teachers to contribute dues to their unions in order to pay the cost of engaging in collective bargaining. It would not be okay to use those dues that are collected on a mandatory basis to engage in political lobbying unrelated to the teachers', you know, work conditions. So, for example, anti-war or pro-ecology or something like that. So this sort of germaneness test that was established there in a later case said very explicitly that it's perfectly okay under the First Amendment to compel teachers specifically to contribute union dues as long as the unions are engaged in collective bargaining or negotiating on their behalf. So Governor Walker is mistaken in that this new case, Harris versus Quinn, does not overrule that earlier case. And at present, at least, there's no precedent that says that the Constitution prevents teachers from being compelled to contribute to their unions.
Linda on Facebook says, this decision will make a hard job even less appealing by castrating the unions and thus making the benefits harder to get and make the employer more likely to abuse their power. Those jobs should be paying more, giving more benefits to attract better people. These are your parents and grandparents that are being taken care of.
As a policy argument, I find that entirely plausible. I think it's important to keep in mind, if you spend much time hanging around right-wing politics, you'll find that public sector unions are their bête noire. So these are the things they hate more than almost anything else. Because to right-wing and libertarian political believers, public sector unions are cases of what's called rent-seeking. That is, they're both part of the government and paid by the government, and they secure their own benefits through this relationship. And so there's a long-standing belief that public sector unions are a uniquely bad thing. And there's very little doubt that this case is designed to weaken those unions, even though it didn't really strike at them directly.
Well, we're going to move on to some other related issues and back to the either the case involving unions, or if you want to ask a question about the other case involving for-profit corporations having religious rights and cannot be forced to cover certain contraceptives for their employees, according to that other U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Let's go back to the phones. Dave in Menominee is with us. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. From what I understand, Hobby Lobby did supply this type of contraceptives before the ACA was made law, and only after Affordable Care Act was brought in that they raised a problem with it. I think this is a huge, you know, the separation of church and state, the wall just crumbled a little bit with this ruling. I do have a problem with it. We have five white Catholic men that ruled this way. And the other corporations that I think probably fall underneath this are probably would be Walmart. That's a family-held corporation, closely knit. They don't allow certain books in their stores, and I would not doubt that they would come up with something like this. The idea that my religious beliefs are overruled by my boss's religious beliefs is, I think, dangerous.
A reaction to that, Professor Schwaber?
Well, there's a lot of pieces to that comment. Mm-hmm. Let me pick up two of them. First, will this ruling apply to a corporation like Walmart? Probably. As I said earlier, Justice Alito kept insisting this only applies to closely held corporations. And by the way, I don't think Walmart legally qualifies as closely held. But Alito also took pains to say that there's no theory under which some corporations are persons and others are not. Well, having said that, how do you maintain this distinction between closely held and publicly held corporations? So, yeah, I don't see any logic within the opinion as it's written that would prevent this rule from being applied to all corporate employers. It's also true, I believe it is the case, that Hobby Lobby used to provide insurance for these very forms of contraception. And so there is this issue of employers discovering religious objections only when the word Obamacare is slapped on to mandatory insurance requirement. On the other side of that argument, there's the question of, you know, I might choose to provide insurance voluntarily. That doesn't mean the federal government can force me to do so. And that could be claimed to be the distinction. On the general question of church and state, this goes back to the backstory of the law at issues in this case, and there isn't time to go into detail, but very briefly, in 1990, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion on behalf of a majority of the Supreme Court saying that there's no constitutional requirement to grant exemptions from generally applicable laws based on religious belief. Congress turned around in 1993 and passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to try to undo that ruling. It was bipartisan, liberal support, conservative support. President Clinton signed it with great fanfare. And liberals, just as much as conservatives, were very eager to protect minority religious rights against the requirements of general laws. So what was at stake in this case is a federal law designed to protect religious liberty against the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court is now allowing corporations to run with that by extending that protection to business entities.
We're talking with Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, an affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School, talking about the political and legal implications of a couple of U.S. Supreme Court rulings yesterday, but it looks like most of you want to talk about the Hobby Lobby case. The court ruled that some for-profit corporations like Hobby Lobby have religious rights and cannot be forced to cover certain contraceptives for their employees. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. A Gallup poll that's out finds public confidence in the Supreme Court at 30%, which is the lowest since Gallup began assessing confidence since 1971. Is this something, Professor Schwaber, that we ought to be worried about, and why? Why is confidence in the Supreme Court dropping?
I think it is something to worry about, and it's ironic, because when he was confirmed as Chief Justice, John Roberts made a big deal of saying to the Senate that his goal was to restore confidence in the court, to bring unity to the court, to restore the court to a position above politics. Instead, he's presided over what seems to me the most intensely political and intensely divided court that we've had since before World War I, and I don't mean that as an exaggeration. It's always easy to accuse the court of playing politics if you don't like a ruling or disagree with an outcome. But the cases where you can really make that a meaningful accusation are where the court reaches much further than it needs to do something much more radical than it has any reason to do, with very little coherent justification or explanation that even makes sense. And that's what we've seen in a whole series of cases, a lot of them involving using the First Amendment as a kind of weapon to strike down swaths of other constitutional priorities in Citizens United, in McCutcheon, and now in these two cases. This court is bitterly divided, and the public is, I think, right to look at what they're doing, the conservative majority, and say, this cannot be explained except by raw political preference.
Let's go to Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. What is the significance that six justices on the Supreme Court are Roman Catholics? Did the religious beliefs of the Supreme Court justices determine their votes and not existing judicial precedents?
Well, you could also point out the other three are Jewish. So it's a very interesting Supreme Court that we have right now from a religious perspective. I certainly don't think, I think it would be entirely unfair and inaccurate to suggest that Alito was simply, you know, espousing Catholic doctrine rather than any kind of legal argument. But there are definitely places where both the argument and even the specific language that he used are redolent of Catholic teaching. So, for example, there is a specific Catholic teaching that says it is as much a sin to enable another to commit a wrong act as to commit it yourself. And Alito used that language in explaining why the religious objection to contraception extends to religious objection to funding insurance to provide contraception, which, if you think about it, is kind of a stretch for most of us. So I don't think it's wrong to say that the Catholic faith of some of the justices influences their thinking. In fact, I think it would be difficult to see how it could fail to do that. At the same time, I certainly would back off of any kind of assertion that this is, you know, simply the imposition of religious law.
Yeah. What about the gender of the Supreme Court justices, with all men on the majority opinion there?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say. I mean, that's certainly an accurate observation. You know, the argument would be that they are less sympathetic in this case, or in the buffer zone case involving abortion clinics, right? Less sympathetic to the concerns of women and the real life challenges that they face out in the world than they would be if they had some shared experience of that life. Yeah. That may be true. It's kind of speculative and hard to be sure. But it's certainly a possibility.
But it is likely to end up in I don't know, the political coverage this year?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
I think the fact that we have, if only from in terms of the political optics, the fact that you have five white male Catholics making a series of highly controversial decisions is going to rub some people the wrong way.
Yeah. Let's go to Margie in Milwaukee. Hello, Margie.
Hi. Thank you, Joy. I disagree with the ruling in so many ways, but one interesting thing I'm thinking about, although it might not make that much difference, but doesn't this open the ability for applicants to jobs to question the religious intent of their employer?
Well, it certainly is the case that applicants for jobs can question the insurance coverage that's provided. And it's an interesting point. I suppose it does suggest that it's germane, for example, for a union or a job applicant or any representative of an employee to ask, in the case of a closely held corporation, whether the majority shareholders have certain religious views in order to determine whether there's a possibility of insurance coverage being changed later. It's a great question, and it points to how entangled these private rights of religious liberties and these public policies about health insurance and worker benefits and how we run our economy, how entangled these things become when we try to use private actors to carry out public purposes.
Gerald on Facebook says, when we allow corporations to tell us how we can use our earned benefits, it becomes no different than that corporation telling us how we can spend our earned income. Overreach or no?
Well, I understand the point. I do think it's slightly overstated. A different way of thinking about it is that the corporation pays a certain compensation. It's a compensation package, and this corporation chooses not to include this as part of its compensation package. It's just as if they paid a lower salary. What's troubling, I think, is the idea that corporations can change that benefits package after you're already employed. So, right, we offer you insurance, but we're now making a new rule that insurance will no longer cover the following things. And that does very much feel like the corporation saying, well, I have a religious prerogative I otherwise would not have to alter your compensation. And again, that's a strange notion of religious liberty.
So is this decision a big blow to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare?
Not really. There are a couple of ways in which the Affordable Care Act can get around this problem, the problem of providing contraceptive coverage, starting with simply providing the same exceptions that are already applied to nonprofit corporations. Part of the reason that the court could go the way that it did is that the administration took the position that they were willing to exempt nonprofit corporations from the requirements of the act, but not for-profit corporations. That's what led Alito to his verbiage about, well, there's no way to distinguish, say, some corporations are persons and others are not. The other thing that, and so there's a whole system of exemptions already in place that could be extended. The other thing that could be done is the Affordable Care Act could be amended so that the government would simply pay directly the insurance costs of coverage not provided by employers under a religious exemption. So it's not a huge blow to the act. It does demonstrate, though, the complexity of trying to get this act to operate in the way that it's intended in the face of a hostile business community and what looks like a fairly hostile judiciary.
So are there other cases that we might see before the court related to the Affordable Care Act or health insurance?
I'm not aware of any right away, but as I said in response to an earlier question, I think it's a dead guarantee that in the next year you'll see cases coming to federal courts where non-closely held corporations will claim the same exemptions. Other corporations will claim exemptions for other areas of coverage. I think this opens the door to a wide range of challenges. And the issue, the general idea that corporations as well as individuals can claim an exemption from federal law if their religion says so, that opens an enormous door, and I think we'll be seeing litigation about that question for a long time to come.
And in our final minute, how do you see this thing playing out in the midterm elections?
Well, the Democrats, I think, will try and tar the Republicans with this opinion by saying, you know, the conservatives are trying to impose their religious values on all of us and trying to use religion in some cases as a cover to avoid providing health care to which people are entitled. I think Republicans will try to play to their base by saying this is about religious freedom. And look, the Supreme Court agrees with us that the Obama administration is anti-Christian and anti-religious. And it will simply further harden those lines and that deep divisiveness that the parties are playing to in trying to mobilize their bases.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison and affiliate faculty member of the UW Law School. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Robin Cherry, and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Coming up, it's another edition of On Your Money. We'll talk about what it means to be rich. What does it mean to you to be rich? Information and advice on your money coming up after we check the news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.